Rich. The teachers at Townsend Regional High School all know Jacob Hunt, even if they haven't had him in class. This is partly due to his current infamy, but I get the sense that, even before he was arrested for murder, he was the kind of kid everyone could spot in the halls, because he stuck out like a sore thumb. After interviewing staff for several hours, and hearing how Jacob used to sit by himself during lunch, and how he'd move from class to class wearing bulky headphones to block out the noise, and the rude comments of classmates, there is a part of me wondering how Jacob managed to wait 18 years to commit murder. What I've learned is that Jacob twisted his schoolwork around his passion for CSI. In English class, when he had to read a biography and give an oral report, he chose Edmund Locar. In math, his independent research project involved Herb McDonald's angled impact of the point of origin of blood spatter. His guidance counselor, Frances Grenville, is a thin, pale woman whose features resemble a garment that's been washed so often its original color has faded.
"Jacob would do anything to fit in," she says as I sit in her office, thumbing through Hunt's file. "Quite often that would make him the butt of jokes. In a way, he was doomed if he tried to fit in, and doomed if he didn't."
She shifts uncomfortably.
"I used to worry he'd bring a gun into school one day, you know, to get even. Like that boy over in Sterling, New Hampshire a few years back."
"Did Jacob ever do that? Get even, I mean?"
"Oh, no, honestly, he's the sweetest child. Sometimes he'd come here during free periods and do his homework in the outer office. He fixed my computer when it crashed once, and even recovered the file I'd been working on. Most of the teachers love him."
"And the rest?"
"Well, some are better with special needs kids than others, but you didn't hear it from me. A student like Jacob can be challenging, to say the least. There's some dead wood in this school, if you know what I mean. And when you get a kid like Jacob who challenges a lesson plan you've been too lazy to adapt for the past 20 years, and when it turns out he's right, well, that doesn't always sit well." She shrugs. "But you can ask the staff. On the whole, Jacob interacted much more fluidly with them than with his peers. He wasn't caught up in the usual high school adolescent drama. Instead, he wanted to talk about politics or scientific breakthroughs, or whether Eugene Onegin was really Pushkin's tour de force. In many ways, having Jacob around was like talking to another teacher." She hesitates. "No, actually, it was like talking to the kind of enlightened scholar that teachers wish they could grow up to be, before bills and car payments and orthodontist appointments get in the way."
If Jacob wanted so badly to fit in with students, what was he doing in the teacher's room, I ask. She shakes her head.
"I suppose there's only so many times you can take being rebuffed before you need some validation," Mrs. Grenville says.
"What do you know about his connection to Jessica Ogilvy?"
"He enjoyed spending time with her. He referred to her as his friend."
I glance up. "How about as his girlfriend?"
"Not that I know of."
"Did Jacob ever have a girlfriend in school?"
"I don't think so. He took a girl to prom last year, but he talked more about Jess, who'd encouraged him to do it, than about his actual date."
"Who else did Jacob hang around with?" I ask. Mrs. Grenville frowns.
"Here's the thing," she says. "If you asked Jacob for a list of his friends, he'd probably be able to give you that list. But if you asked those same kids for their lists, Jacob wouldn't be on them. His Asperger's leads him to mistake proximity for emotional connection. So, for example, Jacob would say he's friendly with the girl he's paired with as a lab partner in physics, even though that might not be a reciprocal feeling."
"So he wasn't considered a discipline problem?" Mrs. Grenville purses her lips.
"No."
I place the open school file on her desk and point to a note inside it. "Then why was Jacob Hunt suspended for assault last year?" Mimi Scheck is the kind of girl I drooled over in high school. in spite of the fact that she wasn't aware we even inhabited the same building for 4 years. She has long black hair and a body made for worship, artfully showcased in clothes that reveal just an inch of skin above the waistline of her jeans when she reaches up or bends down. She also looks so nervous that she'd bolt, if not for the fact that Mrs. Grenville just closed the door of her office. "Hi, Mimi," I say, smiling. "How are you doing today?" She looks from me to the guidance counselor, her lips pressed tight. Then she melts into the couch, anguished.
"I swear, I didn't know about the vodka until I got to Esme's."
"Well, that's interesting, but it's not why I asked to speak to you today."
"It's not?" Mimi whispers. "Oh, crap."
"I wanted to ask you about Jacob Hunt." Her face goes beet red.
"I don't really know him very well."
"You were involved in an incident last year that led to his suspension, right?"
"It was all just a big joke," she says, rolling her eyes. "I mean, how was I supposed to know he couldn't even take a joke?"
"What happened?" She sinks down farther on Mrs. Grenville's couch.
"He was always hanging around. It was creepy, you know? I mean, I'd be like talking to my friends, and he'd be standing there eavesdropping. And then I got a 40 on a math quiz because Mr. LeBlanc is the biggest jerk ever, and I got really mad and asked to be excused to go to the bathroom. But I never went to the bathroom. I just went around the corner and started crying because if I failed math again, my parents were going to take away my phone and make me give up my Facebook account. And Jacob walked up to me. I guess he'd left class for one of his weirdo breaks or something, and he was headed back. He didn't say anything, he just kept staring at me, so I told him to get lost. So he said he would stay with me because that's what friends do, and I said that if he really wanted to be my friend, he'd go into math class and tell Mr. LeBlanc to go fuck himself."
Mimi hesitated.
"So he did."
I glance at the guidance counselor. "And that's why he was suspended?"
"No, he got detention for that."
"And then?" I ask. Mimi's gaze slides away.
"The next day, a bunch of us were hanging out in the commons when Jacob showed up. I guess I sort of ignored him. I mean, it's not like I was actively being mean to him or anything. And he just went crazy and came after me."
"He hit you?" She shakes her head.
"He grabbed me and threw me against a locker. He could have killed me, you know, if a teacher hadn't stopped him."
"Can you show me how he grabbed you?" Mimi looks at Mrs. Grenville, who nods, encouraging her. We both stand up, and Mimi takes a step forward until she has backed me against the wall. She has to reach up because I'm taller than she is, and then gingerly, she wraps her right hand around my throat.
"Like this," she says. "I had bruises for a week."
The same bruises, I realize, that Jess Ogilvy had revealed at her autopsy.
Emma. As if I need any further reminder after Oliver Bond's visit that my life is not, and never will be, what it was, my editor calls. "I was hoping you could come in this afternoon," Tanya says. "There's something we need to discuss." "I can't." "Tomorrow morning?" "Tanya," I say, "Jacob's under house arrest. I'm not allowed to leave." "Well, that's sort of why I wanted to meet. We think that it might be best for everyone right now if you took a leave of absence from your column." "Best for everyone?" I repeat. "How is losing my job best for me?" "It's temporary, Emma, just until this blows over. Surely you understand," Tanya explains. "We can't really endorse advice from a writer whose son was accused of murder," I finish for her. I write anonymously. No one knows about me, much less Jacob. For how long? We're in the news business. Someone's going to dig this up, and then we'll be the ones who look like idiots. By all means, I say hotly. We wouldn't want you to look like idiots. We're not cutting you off. Bob's agreed to keep you at half salary plus benefits if you do freelance editing of the Sunday section for us in return. Is this the part where I'm supposed to fall to my knees in gratitude? I ask. She's quiet for a moment. For what it's worth, Emma, Tanya says. You're the last person in the world who deserves this. You've already got your cross to bear. Jacob, I say, is not a cross to bear. He's my son. My hand is shaking where it holds the phone. Go edit your own fucking Sunday section, I tell her, and I hang up. A tiny cry escapes as I realize the magnitude of what I've just done. I'm a single parent. I hardly make any money as is. I can't work outside the home right now. How am I going to afford to live without a job? I could call my old boss from the textbook company and beg for freelance assignments, but it's been 20 years since I worked there. I could scrape by on whatever savings we've got until this is over. And when will that be? I admit, I've taken our legal system for granted. I assumed that the innocent prevail, that the guilty get their due. But as it turns out, it isn't as simple as saying you're not guilty if you're not guilty. As Oliver Bond has pointed out, the jury has to be convinced. And connecting with strangers is Jacob's weakest link. I keep waiting to wake up. To have someone surprise me with the hidden camera and tell me this is all a big joke. That of course Jacob is free to go. That of course there's been some mistake. But no one surprises me. And I wake up every morning and nothing has changed. The worst thing that could happen would be if Jacob goes to prison again, because they don't understand him there. On the other hand, if he's hospitalized, he'll be with doctors. Oliver said that he'd be kept in a secure treatment facility until the judge could be sure that he wouldn't hurt anyone again, which means that he'd have a chance, however slight, of getting out one day. I pull myself up the stairs, heavily, as if my feet have been cast in lead. At Jacob's door, I knock. He's sitting on his bed, flowers for Algernon folded on his chest. I finished, he says. As part of our new homeschooling protocol, I have to make sure he keeps up with the school curriculum, and this novel was the first assignment for his English class. And? It was stupid. I always thought it was sad. It's stupid, Jacob reiterates, because he should never have had the experiment done. I sit down beside him. In the narrative, Charlie Gordon, a retarded man, undergoes a surgical procedure that triples his IQ, only to have the experiment ultimately fail and leave him with subnormal intelligence again. Why not? He got to see what he was missing. But if he never had that procedure, he would never know he was missing it. When Jacob says things like this, truths so raw most of us won't even admit them in silence, much less speak them out loud, he seems more lucid than anyone else I know. I do not believe my son is insane. And I do not believe that his Asperger's is a disability either. If Jacob didn't have Asperger's, he wouldn't be the same boy I love so fiercely. the one who watches Casablanca with me and can recite all of Bogey's dialogue. The one who remembers the grocery list in his head when I've inadvertently left it sitting on the counter. The one who never ignores me if I ask him to get my wallet out of my handbag or run upstairs to get a ream of paper for the printer. Would I have rather had a kid who doesn't struggle so hard? Who could make his way in the world with less resistance? No, because that child wouldn't have been Jacob. The crises may be what stick in my mind when it comes to him, but the in-between moments are the ones I wouldn't have missed for the world. Still, I know why Charlie Gordon had the procedure done. And I know why I'm about to have a conversation with Jacob that makes my heart feel like it's turned to ash. It's because, whenever possible, humans err on the side of hope. I have to talk to you about what Oliver said, I begin. Jacob sits up. I'm not crazy. I'm not letting him say that about me. Just hear me out. It's not the truth, Jacob says. And you always have to tell the truth, house rules. You're right. But sometimes it's okay to tell a little lie if it gets you to the truth in the long run. He blinks. Saying I'm insane isn't a little lie. I look at him. I know you didn't kill Jess. I believe you. But you have to get 12 strangers on a jury to believe you. How are you going to do that?
I'm going to tell them the truth.
Okay, pretend we're in court then and tell it to me. His eyes flicker across my face and then fix on the window behind me.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
That's exactly what I mean. You can't use movie quotes in a courtroom to say what happened, but you can use a lawyer. I grasp his arms. I want you to promise me that you'll let Oliver say whatever he has to in order for you to win this case. He jerks his chin down.
One martini, please,
he mutters.
Shaken, not stirred.
I'm going to take that as a yes, I say.
Theo. If a school day is 7 hours long, 6 of those are eaten up by blocks of time that are full of nothing but crap. Teachers yelling at kids who misbehave. Gossip as you walk to your locker. Recap of a math concept you understood the first time it was explained. What being homeschooled has taught me, more than anything, is what a waste of a life high school is. When it's just me and Jacob sitting at the kitchen table, I can blow through my work in about an hour's time if I leave the reading stuff for before I fall asleep. It helps that my mother second-guesses the curriculum a lot. We're skipping this part. If imaginary numbers were meant to be learned, they would have made themselves real. Or, for God's sake, how many times have you studied the Puritans now since first grade? 100? Let's just move on to the Reformation. At any rate, I like being homeschooled. By definition, you're an outcast, so you don't have to worry about sounding stupid if you give the wrong answer, or if that hot girl from your English class is checking you out when you go up to the whiteboard to write your equation for the math homework. I mean, we don't even have a whiteboard here. Since Jacob works on different stuff than I do, he's buried in his work on one end of the table and I'm at the other. I finish before him, but then again, I did even when we worked on regular homework before. He may be freaking brilliant, but sometimes whatever's cooking in his brain doesn't quite translate onto the page. I guess it's a little like being the world's fastest bullet train, but your wheels don't fit the rails. As soon as I finish my French homework, que fait ton frère? Il va à la prison. I close my textbook. My mom looks up from her cup of coffee. Usually she's typing away at her computer, but she hasn't even been able to focus on that today. Done, I announce. She stretches out her lips, and I know it's supposed to be a smile. Great. You need me to do anything? I ask. Turning back time would be nice. I was thinking more along the lines of the grocery store, I suggest. We have, like, nothing to eat here. It's true, and she knows it. She isn't allowed to leave the house as long as Jacob's stuck here, and that means we're on a slow road to starvation unless I do something about it. You can't drive, she says. I've got my skateboard. She arches a brow. Theo, you cannot skateboard with groceries. Why not? I'll use those green bags I can loop over my arms, and I won't buy anything heavy. It doesn't take her very long to be convinced, but then we hit another snafu. She has only $10 in her wallet, and I can't very well pretend to be Emma Hunt when I hand over her credit card. Hey, Jacob, I say, we need to borrow some money. He doesn't look up from his history book. Do I look like a bank? Are you kidding me? My brother has, I swear, every dollar he's been given for a birthday, Christmas, you name it. I've only seen him spend money once on a 35-cent pack of gum. Don't, my mother says quietly. Let's not get him upset. Instead, she rummages in her wallet and pulls out her ATM card. Stop off at the bank in the shopping center and take out some cash. My PIN is 4550. Really? I say, beaming. You just gave me your PIN? Yes, so don't make me regret it. I grab the card and head out of the kitchen. So, is it your computer password, too? Soy milk, she says, and gluten-free bread and no-salt ham, and anything else you want. I make the executive decision to not take my skateboard and instead walk to the bank. It's only 2 miles into town anyway. I keep my head ducked and tell myself it's because of the wind, but really it's because I don't want to run into anyone I know. I pass cross-country skiers on the golf course and a pair of joggers. When I get to the bank, I realize that it's after hours, and I don't know how to get into the little lobby where the ATM is located. Instead, I walk around to the back of the building where there's a drive-up machine. I stand behind a Honda and wait my turn. Enter amount, the screen reads. I type in $200, and then I hesitate and cancel the transaction. Instead of doing a withdrawal, I look up the account balances. Could we really have only $3,356 in our savings account? I try to remember whether my mother gets statements from more banks than just this one. If there's a safe in our house where she keeps money. I know that the Townsend Inn hires 15-year-olds as busboys for the restaurant, and I'm pretty sure that if I can get a lift into Burlington, I could work at the McDonald's. Clearly, if someone needs to be employed, it's me, since my mother can't leave the house right now, and since Jacob has proven himself pathologically incapable of holding down a job. He's had 3. The first was working at a pet store in town, back when he was obsessive about dogs. He got fired for telling his boss that she was stupid to keep the dog food in the back of the store, since the bags were so heavy. The second job he had was bagging groceries at a food co-op, where the cashiers kept telling him to get his ducks in a row as the items came down the conveyor belt, and then got mad because he wouldn't listen, when in reality, Jacob probably just didn't understand. The third job was selling concessions at a snack bar during the summer at the town pool. I guess that worked out fine for the first hour or so, but when lunchtime came and there were 6 kids shouting to him for snow cones and hot dogs and nachos all at once, he took off his apron and just walked out. A car drives up behind me, which makes me feel like a moron. I shuffle my feet and punch the withdrawal button and then enter $200 on the keypad. When the money comes out of the mouth of the machine, I stuff it into my pocket. And then I hear my name being called. Theo? Theo Hunt, is that you? I feel guilty, as if I've been caught in the act of doing something I shouldn't be. But it's not like illegal to walk up to a drive-up ATM, is it? The door of the car behind me opens, and out steps my biology teacher, Mr. Jennison. "How are you doing?" he asks. I remember how once, when my mother was getting on Jacob's back because he refused to make small talk at a distant cousin's wedding, he said that he would have asked Aunt Marie how she was doing if he really truly cared. But he didn't. So pretending he did would be a big lie. There are times when Jacob's world makes a lot more sense to me than the one the rest of us live in. Why do we ask people how they're doing when we don't give a crap about the answer? Is Mr. Jennison asking me that question because he's worried about me, or because it's something to say to fill up the air between us? "I'm okay," I say, because old habits die hard. If I were like Jacob, I would have answered directly. "I can't sleep at night, and sometimes when I run too fast, I can't breathe." But in reality, someone who asks you how you're doing doesn't want to hear the truth. He wants the pat answer, the expected response, so that he can go on his merry way. "You need a lift? It's freezing out here." There are some teachers I have really liked and others I've really disliked, but Mr. Jennison doesn't fall into either category. He's nondescript, from his thinning hair to his lectures. The kind of teacher whose name I'll probably forget by the time I go to college. I'm pretty sure that until recently, he could say the same about me. I was an average student in his class who didn't excel or fail enough to leave an impression. Until, of course, all this happened. Now I'm the boy at the center of 6 degrees of separation. "Oh yeah, my aunt was Theo's third grade teacher." Or, "I sat behind him at a school assembly once." I'm the kid whose name they'll toss out at cocktail parties years from now. "That autistic murderer kid, I was in his brother's class at Townsend High." "My mom's double parked across the street," I mumble, realizing too late, if our car was indeed in town, it would most likely be at this drive-through ATM right now. "Thanks anyway," I say, and I leave in such a hurry that I almost forget to take the transaction receipt. I jog all the way to the grocery store as if I'm expecting Mr. Jennison to tail me in his car and call me a liar to my face. Only once do I think about taking the $200 and hopping on a bus and leaving for good. I imagine sitting in the back seat next to a pretty girl who shares her trail mix with me, or an old lady who's knitting a cap for her newborn grandson, who asks me where I'm headed. I imagine telling her that I'm going to visit my big brother at college, that we're really close, and that I miss him when he's away at school. I imagine how cool it would be if small talk wasn't lies. When I'm getting ready to go to sleep that night, my toothbrush goes missing. Furious, this isn't the first time this has happened, believe me, I stalk down the hall to my brother's room. Jacob's got an audio tape of Abbott and Costello's Who's on First routine playing on an old tape deck. "What the hell did you do with my toothbrush this time?" I ask. "I didn't touch your stupid toothbrush." But I don't believe him. I glance at the old fish tank he uses for a fuming chamber, but it's not there. It was seized as evidence. Abbott's and Costello's voices are so faint I can barely make out the words. "Can you even hear that?" I say. "It's loud enough." I remember once at Christmas when my mom got Jacob a watch. She had to return it because the ticking noise drove him crazy. "I'm not crazy," Jacob says. And for a second, I wonder if I've spoken out loud. "I never said you were." "Yes, you did," Jacob says. He's probably right. His memory's like a steel trap. Considering all the shit you steal from my room for your fuming chamber and your crime scenes, I think we can call it even. "What's the guy's name on first base?" "No, what's on second?" "I'm not asking you who's on second. Who's on first?" "I don't know. He's on third. We're not talking about him." Okay, so I know some people find that comedy routine hilarious, but I've never been one of them. Probably the reason Jacob likes it so much is that it makes perfect sense to him, since the names are taken literally. Maybe it got thrown out, Jacob says. And at first I think it's Costello's line, until I realize that he's talking about my toothbrush. Did you do it? I ask. Jacob stares at me. It always gives me a jolt when that happens, because he spends so much time not looking me in the eye. Did you? He replies. Suddenly, I'm not sure what we're talking about, but I don't think it's oral hygiene. Before I can respond, my mother sticks her head in the doorway. Which one of you does this belong to? She asks, holding up my toothbrush. It was in my bathroom. I grab it from her. On the cassette deck, Abbott and Costello are arguing over the canned laugh track. Now that's the first thing you've said right. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I told you so, Jacob says.
This ends Disc 9. House Rules, Disc 10.
Jacob. When I was little, I convinced my brother that I had superpowers. Why else would I be able to hear what our mother was doing upstairs when we were downstairs? Why not say that the reason fluorescent bulbs made me dizzy was that I was so sensitive to light? When I missed a question Theo asked me, I told him it was because I could hear so many conversations and background noises at once that sometimes it was hard for me to focus on just one sound at a time. For a while, it worked. And then my brother figured out I wasn't gifted with extrasensory perception. I was just strange. Having Asperger's is like having the volume of life at full blast all the time. It's like a permanent hangover. Although I admit I have only been drunk once, when I tried Grey Goose straight to see the effect it would have on me, and was dismayed to learn that, rather than giggling like everyone on television who's drunk, I only felt more displaced and disoriented, and the world only got more fuzzy and indistinct. All those little autistic kids you see smacking their heads against walls, they're not doing it because they're mental. They're doing it because the rest of the world is so loud it actually hurts, and they're trying to make it all go away. It's not just sight and sound that are ratcheted up either. My skin is so sensitive that I can tell you whether my shirt is cotton or polyester just by its temperature against my back. I have to cut all the labels out of my clothes so they don't rub, because they feel like coarse sandpaper. If someone touches me when I'm not expecting it, I scream. Not out of fear, but because it sometimes feels like my nerve endings are on the outside rather than the inside. And it's not just my body that's hypersensitive. My mind is usually in overdrive. I've always thought it strange when someone describes me as robotic or flat, because if anything, I'm always panicked about something. I don't like to interact with people if I can't predict how they're going to respond. I never wonder what I look like from someone else's point of view. I would never even have thought to consider that if my mother hadn't brought it to my attention. If I give a compliment, it's not because it's the right thing to say, it's because it's true. Even routine language doesn't come easily to me. If you say thank you, I have to rummage around in my database brain for you're welcome. I can't chat about the weather just for the sake of filling up silence. The whole time I'm thinking, this is so fake. If you're wrong about something, I'll correct you. Not because I want to make you feel bad. In fact, I'm not thinking of you at all. But because facts are very important to me. More important than people are. Nobody ever asks Superman if X-ray vision is a drag, if it gets old looking into brick buildings and seeing guys beat their wives, or lonely women getting wasted, or losers surfing porn sites. Nobody ever asks Spider-Man if he gets vertigo. If their superpowers are anything like mine, it's no wonder they're always putting themselves in harm's way. They're probably hoping for a quick death.
Rich. Mama Spatakopoulos will not talk to me until I agree to eat a little something, which is how I wind up with a full plate of spaghetti and meatballs as I ask her questions about Jess Ogilvy. "Do you remember this girl?" I ask, showing her a photo of Jess.
"Yes, the poor thing. I saw in the news what happened."
"I understand that she came here a few days before she was killed." The woman nods.
"With her boyfriend and that other one."
"You mean Jacob Hunt?" I show her a picture of Jacob, too.
"That's him," she shrugs.
"Do you have any security cameras in here?"
"No, why? Is the neighborhood dangerous?"
"I just thought I might be able to see the interaction that afternoon," I say.
"Oh, I can tell you that," Mama Spatakopoulos says. "It was a big fight."
"What happened?"
"The girl, she was very upset. She was crying, and eventually she ran out. She stuck the Hunt kid with the bill and the whole pizza."
"Do you know why she was upset?" I ask. "What they were fighting about?"
"Well," the woman says, "I couldn't hear everything, but it seemed like he was jealous."
"Miss Spatakopoulos," I lean forward, "this is very important. Did you hear anything Jacob said in particular that was threatening to Jess, or see him physically attack her in any way?" Her eyes widen.
"Oh, it wasn't Jacob who was jealous," she says. "It was the other one, the boyfriend."
When I intercept Mark McGuire, he's leaving the student center with two of his buddies. "How was lunch, Mark?" I ask, stepping away from the lamppost against which I've been leaning. "Did you order pizza? Was it as good as Mama Spatakopoulos's?" "You've got to be kidding," he says. "I'm not talking to you." "I'd think as a grieving boyfriend you'd want to do just that." "You know what I want to do? Sue the shit out of you for what you did to me." "I let you go," I said, shrugging. "People get unarrested all the time." I fall into step beside him. "I just had a really interesting chat with the pizza lady. She seems to remember you and Jess fighting when you were there." Mark starts walking, and I fall into step beside him.
"So what?"
"So we fought. I already told you that." "What was that fight about?"
"Jacob Hunt. Jess thought he was some helpless moron, and the whole time he was using that act to get her interested in him."
"Interested how?"
"He wanted her," Mark says. "He played pathetic so that she'd be in the palm of his hand. At the restaurant, he had the nerve to ask her out in front of me, like I wasn't even there. All I did was put Hunt in his place and remind him that his mommy was buying him Jess's company."
"How did she react?"
"She got pissed."
He stops in his tracks and faces me.
"Look, maybe I'm not the most sensitive guy.
Gee, I didn't notice." Mark glares at me.
"I'm trying to make a point here. I said and did things I'm not proud of. I'm jealous. I wanted to be number one on Jess's list. Maybe I crossed the line a few times, trying to make sure of that. But I never would have hurt her, never. The reason I started the fight at the pizza place in the first place was to protect her. She trusted everyone. She only saw the good in people. I could read right through Hunt's bullshit, even if Jess couldn't."
"What do you mean?"
He folds his arms. "My freshman year roommate still played with Pokemon cards. He never showered, and he pretty much lived in the computer lab. I probably said less than 10 sentences to him all year. He was fucking brilliant. Graduated early and went to go design missile systems for the Pentagon or something. He probably had Asperger's too. But no one ever slapped a label on him other than nerd. All I'm saying is that there's a difference between being mentally retarded and being socially retarded. One's a handicap. The other's just a get-out-of-jail-free card."
"I think current psychiatry might trump you, Mark. There's a difference between being socially awkward and being clinically diagnosed with Asperger's."
Yeah, he meets my gaze. That's what Jess used to say. And now she's dead.
Oliver. When I step into the kitchen at the Hunt's house for the second day in a row, Emma is cooking something at the stove while Jacob sits at the kitchen table. I look from his face, bent toward the table over a gruesome collection of crime scene photography, to his mother's. Go ahead, Emma says. The Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination by the state or local government, including in the courts, Jacob recites in his monotone. In order to be protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, you have to have a disability or have a relationship with someone with a disability. A person with a disability is defined as a person with a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, like communication, or is a person who is perceived by others as having such an impairment. He flips a page. Now the pictures are of bodies in a morgue. Who the hell publishes this kind of book? Dr. Moon and my mother say I have quirks, but other people, like my teachers and the kids at school and that judge, might assume I have a disability, Jacob adds. I shake my head. I don't really understand. There's a logical and valid legal reason for you to speak for me, Jacob says. You may use the insanity defense if you think it will work best during the trial. He stands up, tucking the book under his arm. But for the record, I personally subscribe to the belief that normal is just a setting on the dryer. I nod, considering this. What movie is that from? Jacob rolls his eyes. Not everything's from a movie, he says, and he walks off. Wow. I walk toward Emma. I don't know how you did that, but thank you. Don't underestimate me, she answers. And with a spatula, she flips the fish that is being sautéed in a pan. Was that the only reason you asked me to come over? I thought that was what you wanted, Emma says. It was, until I smelled what you were cooking. I grin. I'll knock $10 off my retainer if you feed me lunch. Don't you have a built-in cafeteria downstairs from your office? A guy gets sick of red sauce every now and then, I say. Come on, surely you could use a little grown-up conversation after being cooped up in the house. Emma makes a pretense of looking around the kitchen. Sure, where's the other grown-up? I'm 10 years older than Jacob, I remind her. So what are we eating? Sea bass with garlic. I sit down at one of the counter stools and watch her carry a pot of boiling something to the sink and dump it in a colander. The steam curls the hair around her face. One of my favorites, I say. I'm so glad you invited me. Fine, she sighs. Stay already. All right, but only if you can contain your enthusiasm for my company. She shakes her head. Make yourself useful and set the table. There's an intimacy to being in someone else's kitchen that makes me homesick. Not for my apartment over the pizza place, but for my childhood home. I grew up as the youngest of a big family in Buffalo. Sometimes, even now, I miss the sound of chaos. My mom used to cook fish on Fridays, I say, as I open and close drawers, trying to find the silverware. Are you Catholic? No, Norwegian. Fish is a Scandinavian aphrodisiac. Emma's cheeks flush. Did it work? My parents had 5 kids, I say, and I gesture at the sea bass. Foreplay on a platter. I guess I could go along with the metaphor, Emma murmurs. My ex's cooking could be considered contraception. Would it be rude to ask how long you've been a single parent? Yes, Emma says. But the short answer is, since Jacob's diagnosis. She takes some milk out of the refrigerator and pours it into a pan, then begins to whip the contents with a hand mixer. He's not involved with Jacob or Theo, except for the monthly child support. Well, you should be proud of doing it all on your own. Yeah, I'm proud. I have a son accused of murder. What mother wouldn't think of herself as a huge success after that? I look up at her. Accused, I repeat. Not convicted. For a long moment she looks at me, as if she is afraid to believe there could be someone else who believes Jacob might not be guilty. Then she begins to make up individual plates. "Jacob! Theo!" she yells, and the boys file into the kitchen. Jacob takes his and immediately returns to the living room and the television. Theo thunders down the stairs, takes one look at me sitting at the table, and frowns. "Shouldn't he be buying us lunch?" he asks. "It's lovely to see you too," I answer. He looks at me. "Whatever." As he shuffles back upstairs with his meal, Emma fixes plates for the two of us. "Usually we all sit down to dinner together," she says, "but sometimes it's nice to have a break from each other, too." I imagine it's hard when you're all under house arrest. It's pretty sad when the high point of my day is walking to the end of the driveway to get the mail. Leaning down, she sets a plate in front of me. There's a block of white fish, creamy white mashed potatoes, and a tiny hill of white rice. "Meringues for dessert, I guess. Angel food cake." I poke at the food with my fork. She frowns. "Is the fish undercooked?" No, it's great. I've just, never seen anyone color coordinate a meal before." "Oh, it's February 1st, she says, as if that explains everything. "The first of every month is a white food day. I've been doing it so long I forget it's not normal." I taste the potatoes. They're out of this world. "What do you do on the 31st? Burn everything to a black crisp?" "Don't give Jacob any ideas," Emma says. "Would you like some milk?" She pours me a glass, and I reach for it. "I don't get it. Why does the color of his food matter? Why does the texture of velvet send him into a panic? Why can't he stand the hum of an espresso machine? There are a million questions I don't have answers for," Emma replies. "So the easiest thing to do is just roll with the punches and keep him from having a meltdown." "Like he did in court," I say. "And jail." "Exactly. So Monday's food is green, Tuesday's is red, Wednesday's is yellow. You get the idea." I think for a moment. "Don't take this the wrong way, but it seems like sometimes Jacob's more adult than you or me. And other times, he gets totally overwhelmed." "That's him. I truly think he's smarter than anyone I've ever met, but he's also more inflexible. And he takes every little thing that happens to heart because he's the center of his universe." "And yours," I point out. "He's the center of your universe, too." She ducks her head. "I guess." Maybe my Scandinavian parents knew what they were doing, because maybe it's the fish, and maybe it's the way she looks in that moment, surprised and a little flustered. But to my shock, I realize I'd like to kiss her. However, I can't, because she's my client's mother, and because she would probably knock me flat on my ass. "I assume you have a plan of attack," she says. My eyes widen. Is she thinking the same thing about me? I tamp down an image of me pinning her to the table. "The quicker the better," Emma says, and my pulse triples. She glances over her shoulder to the living room, where Jacob is slowly shoveling rice into his mouth. "I just want this whole nightmare to be over." And with those words, I come crashing back to my sad little reality. I clear my throat, totally professional. "The most damaging discovery is the confession Jacob made. We need to try to get rid of it." "I thought I was going to be able to sit with Jacob in the interrogation room. If I'd been there, it would never have gotten this far. I just know it. They had to be asking him questions he didn't understand, or firing them at him too fast." "We have a transcript. The questions were pretty straightforward, I think. Did you tell Mattson that Jacob had Asperger's before they started talking?" "Yes, when he came to interview Jacob the first time."
"First time?"
Emma nods.
"He was going through Jess's appointment book, and Jacob's social skills lesson was on it, so the detective asked him a few questions."
"Were you there to help translate?"
"Right here at the kitchen table," Emma says. Mattson acted like he completely understood Jacob's issues. That's why, when he told me to bring Jacob to the station, I assumed it was going to be the same sort of interview and that I could be part of it. That's good, actually, I tell her. We can probably file a motion to suppress. What's that? Before I can answer, Jacob comes into the kitchen with his empty plate. He sets it in the sink and then pours himself a glass of Coca-Cola. Under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, you have a right to remain silent unless you waive that right, and in certain circumstances, if the police don't read you your Miranda rights or properly ask you to waive them, anything you say can be used against you. A defense attorney can file a motion to suppress in order to prevent that evidence from coming before the jury. Then he walks back to the living room. That's just plain wrong, I mutter. It is? Yeah, I say. How come he gets to drink Coke on White Food Day? It takes a moment, and then, for the very first time, I hear the music of Emma Hunt's laugh.
Emma. I didn't expect to feed Jacob's lawyer lunch. I didn't expect to enjoy his company so much either. But when he makes a joke about White Food Day, which is, let's face it, as ridiculous as everyone in the fairy tale pretending the emperor is beautifully clothed instead of stark naked, I can't help myself. I start to giggle. And before I know it, I am laughing so hard I cannot catch my breath. Because when you get right down to it, it's funny when I ask my son, "How did you sleep?" And he answers, "On my stomach." It's funny when I tell Jacob I'll be there in a minute and he starts counting down from 60. It's funny that Jacob used to grab my collar every time I came home, his interpretation of catch you later. It's funny when he begs for a forensics textbook on Amazon.com and I ask him to give me a ballpark figure and he says, second base. And it's funny when I move heaven and earth to give Jacob white food on the first of the month and he breezily pours himself a glass of Coke. It's true what they say about Asperger's affecting the whole family. I've been doing this for so long, I forgot to consider what an outsider would think of our pale rice and fish, our long-standing routines. Just like Jacob has no capacity to put himself in the shoes of someone else he encounters. And, as Jacob has learned one rebuff at a time, what looks pitiful from one angle looks absolutely hilarious from another. Life's not fair, I tell Oliver.
That's the reason there are defense attorneys, he replies. And Jacob's right about the legal jargon, by the way. I'm going to file a motion to suppress because the police were on notice that they weren't dealing with someone mentally able to truly understand his Miranda rights. I know my Miranda rights, Jacob yells from the other room. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. I've got it, Jacob. I'm good, Oliver calls back. He stands up and puts his plate on the counter. Thanks for lunch. I'll let you know what happens with the hearing. I walk him to the door and watch him unlock his car. Instead of getting into it, though, he reaches into the back seat and then walks toward me again, his face sober. There's just one more thing, Oliver says. He reaches for my hand and presses a miniature-sized Milky Way into it. Just in case you want to sneak it in before Brown Thursday, he whispers. And for the second time that day, he leaves me smiling.
Case 7. Blood is thicker than water. Ernest Brendel's sister didn't believe her brother's friend, who came to tell her one fall day in 1991, that Ernest had been kidnapped, along with his wife, Alice, and young daughter, Emily, as part of a mafia scheme. But Christopher Hightower insisted that they needed ransom money, and as proof, he took her outside to Ernest's Toyota, the car he'd driven there. He pointed to the back seat, which was soaked through with blood. There was more blood in the trunk. Eventually, police would match that blood evidence to Ernest Brendel. But they'd also prove that Hightower, not the mafia, was to blame for Brendel's death. To most people, Chris Hightower was a commodities broker with ties to his Rhode Island community. He taught Sunday school and worked with at-risk kids. But one fall day in 1991, he went on a murder rampage, killing his friend Ernest Brendel and Brendel's family. Facing financial trouble and estranged from his wife, Hightower purchased a crossbow and drove to Brendel's house. He hid in the garage and fired an arrow into Brendel's chest when the man arrived back home. While trying to escape, Brendel was shot twice more. He managed to crawl into the second car in the garage, a Toyota, where Hightower smashed his skull with a crowbar. Hightower then picked Emily up from an after-school program at the YMCA by offering Brendel's license as proof that he was a family friend who could be trusted to take the girl home. When Alice Brendel arrived home that night, she and Emily were drugged with sleeping pills. It was the last time anyone from the Brendel family was seen alive. The next day, Hightower bought a brush, a hose, some muriatic acid, and a 50-pound bag of lime. He scrubbed the garage with muriatic acid to clean up the blood. He cleaned the car with baking soda and washed away more blood. 6 weeks later, a woman walking a dog stumbled over two shallow graves. One housed the remains of Ernest Brendel. The second held Alice Brendel, found with a scarf wrapped around her neck, and Emily, who was believed to have been buried alive. In the grave was an empty bag of lime. In the Toyota that Hightower had been driving, police found the torn corner of that bag of lime, as well as the Home Depot receipt for the lime and the muriatic acid. Hightower was convicted and is serving 3 life sentences. With friends like that, who needs enemies?
Chapter 7. Theo. I've done the math. Eventually, I'm going to be the one who has to take care of my brother. Don't get me wrong. I'm not such a colossal ass that I'm going to totally ignore Jacob when we're grown up and when, I can't even imagine this, Mom isn't around. What sort of pisses me off, though, is the silent assumption that when Mom is unable to pick up after Jacob's messes anymore, 3 guesses who will have to take over. Once, I read this news story on the internet about a woman in England whose son was retarded, big-time retarded, not disabled the way Jacob is disabled, but, like, unable to brush his own teeth or remember to go to the bathroom when the urge strikes. Let me just say here that if Jacob wakes up one day and needs an adult diaper, I don't care if I'm the last person on earth, I'm not changing it. Anyway, this woman, she had emphysema, and she was slowly dying, and it got to a point where she could barely sit up in a wheelchair all day, much less help her son out. Then there was a photo of her with her son, and although I was expecting a kid my age, Ronnie was easily in his 50s. He had a chin full of thick stubble and a pot belly poking out from his Power Rangers t-shirt, and he was giving his mother this big, gummy smile while he hugged her in her wheelchair, where she sat with tubes running into her nose. I couldn't take my eyes off Ronnie. It was like I suddenly realized that one day when I was married with a house full of rugrats and doing the corporate thing, Jacob might still be watching his stupid Crime Busters episodes and eating yellow foods on Wednesdays. My mom and Dr. Moon, Jacob's shrink, always talked about this abstractly as evidence of why they thought vaccines had something to do with autism and why autism was a relatively new phenomenon. If it's really been around forever, where are all the autistic kids who've grown up and become adults? Because believe me, even if they'd been diagnosed as something else, we'd know who they are. But until that very second, I hadn't made the connection that one day Jacob would be one of those adults with autism. Sure, he might be lucky enough to hold down a job like all those Aspies in Silicon Valley. But when he had a meltdown and started destroying his cubicle at said job, we all know who they'd call first. Ronnie clearly never had grown up, and never would. And that was why his mother was being featured in this newspaper, The Guardian. She'd placed an ad asking for a family that would take in Ronnie and treat him like their own when she was dead. He was a sweet boy, she said, even if he still wet the bed. Good freaking luck, I'd thought. Who takes on someone else's crap willingly? I wondered what kind of people would respond to Ronnie's mom. Mother Teresa types, maybe. Or those families that you always see in the back pages of People magazine who foster parent 20 special needs kids and somehow manage to shape them into a family. Or worse, maybe some lonely old perv who figured a fellow like Ronnie wouldn't realize if he was copping a feel every now and then. Ronnie's mom said a group home wasn't an option since he'd never been in one and couldn't adapt to one at this point. All she wanted was someone who might love him the way she did. Anyway, the article got me thinking about Jacob. He could handle a group home, maybe, if he were still allowed to shower first in the morning. But if I tossed him into one, and don't ask me how you even go about getting a spot, what would that say about me? That I was too selfish to be my brother's keeper? That I didn't love him? Well, still, a little voice in my head said, you never signed on for this. Then I realized, neither did my mother, but it didn't make her love Jacob any less. So here's the deal. I know that down the road, Jacob will be my responsibility. When I find a girl I want to marry, I'm going to have to propose with this contingency, that Jacob and me, we're a package deal. When I least expect it, I might have to make excuses for him, or talk him down from his freakout session, like my mom does now. I'm not saying this out loud, but there's a part of me that's been thinking if Jacob is convicted of murder, if he's imprisoned for life, well, mine gets a little bit easier. I hate myself for even thinking that, but I'm not going to lie to you. And I guess it doesn't matter if it's guilt that gets me to take care of Jacob in the future or love, because I'll do it. It just would have been nice to be asked, you know?
Oliver. Mama Spatakopoulos is standing at my office apartment door with the day's offering. We had a little extra rigatoni, she says. And you're working so hard. You look skinnier every day. I laugh and take the container out of her hands. It smells incredible. And Thor starts jumping around my ankles to make sure I don't forget to give him his cut of the bounty. Thanks, Mrs. S., I say. And as she turns to leave, I call her back. Hey, what food do you know that's yellow? I've been thinking about how Emma feeds Jacob according to his color scheme. Hell, I've been thinking about Emma, period. You mean like a scrambled egg? I snap my fingers. Right, I say. Omelets with Swiss cheese. She frowns. You want me to make you an omelet? Hell no. I'm sticking to the rigatoni. Before I can explain the rest, my office phone starts to ring. Excusing myself, I hurry back inside and pick it up. Oliver Bond's office, I say. Note to self. Helen Sharp replies. That line's a little more effective when you hire someone else to deliver it. My secretary just stepped out to use the restroom. She snorts. Yeah, and I'm Miss America. Congratulations, I say, my voice dripping with sarcasm. What's your talent? Juggling the heads of defense attorneys? She ignores me. I'm calling about the suppression hearing. You subpoenaed Rich Mattson? The detective? Well, yeah. Who else was I supposed to subpoena? After all, in a motion that would try to suppress Jacob's confession at the police station. You don't have to subpoena him. I have to have Mattson there, and I go first. What do you mean you go first? It's my motion. I know, but this is one of those weird cases where, even though it's your motion, the state has the burden of proof, and we have to put on all the evidence to prove the confession is good. For practically every other motion, it's the other way around. If I want a ruling, I have to work my ass off to prove why I deserve it. How on earth was I supposed to know the exception to this rule? I'm glad Helen's not in the room with me, because my face is bright red. Well, jeez, I say, feigning nonchalance. I know that. I was just seeing if you were on your toes. While I have you on the phone, Oliver, I have to tell you, I don't think you can play this case both ways. What do you mean? You can't claim your client's insane and that he didn't understand his Miranda rights. He recited them from memory, for God's sake. Where's the conflict? I ask. Who the hell memorizes Miranda verbatim? Thor starts to bite my ankles, and I spill a little rigatoni into his dog dish. Look, Helen, Jacob couldn't do 3 days in jail.